Hey, I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains, and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I think it's great. The Seine is Paris. The Seine is in the middle of Paris with all the history around the Seine River, with the monument, with, of course, the Eiffel Tower.
The Seine is Paris, an iconic landmark, a spot to watch the sunset, to take a romantic boat ride, but definitely not a river where you'd jump in for a swim. The Seine is polluted with pathogens from sewage waste, and swimming there, well, that's been off limits for decades. The 2024 Summer Olympics are coming up, though, and in less than 500 days, and Paris is hosting. So there are big plans to clean the river and make it safe for swimming competitions. Parisians are curious to see if their Seine will be swimmable again.
So, yes, I think it's a very good idea. I think it was a long way to achieve this finality.
I think that we need to clean it, but I'm not sure that I'm going to swim in it. It's part of our history, but and it's also something cultural, but I think that tourists get more into the Seine than us.
It's certainly a good idea, but I don't think it will really happen. Because, for example, Jacques Chirac back in 88 said, "I would drink my Ricard with the water of the Seine." You know what? We're still waiting.
Dan Angelesco has been tracking the Seine's water quality as part of the cleanup operation. He's a scientist and the founder and CEO of the water quality solutions company, Fluidian. Dan, good morning.
Good morning.
So you heard some Parisians, positive, but a bit of skepticism. Does that surprise you?
No, it does not surprise me at all. A bit of skepticism is healthy, and the Seine River is a huge river, and it carries the sewage of all of the Paris region. That's the main conduit for the treated waters, and traditionally it has been quite polluted. So yes, I understand that people can be skeptical about that, but there are efforts underway to change that.
We're going to get to that, but how polluted is it?
Well, it really depends on the time of the year and on the weather mostly, because it's usually most of the pollution gets into the river when there is a big storm event. And since there are combined sewers, the rainwater and the sewage sort of mix together. And there is so much water that the treatment plants cannot treat. So the excess water, if you'd like, mixed with sewage, goes directly into the river, which is called a combined sewer overflow. And this is what brings really a lot of pollution into the river when there is a storm event. And, during those days, yeah, it is unswimmable. However, if you have a long stretch of good weather, actually water quality can get pretty good.
You know, they're infamous, those sewers, of course. They take tours of them. I've been down there myself. Victor Hugo used to write about those sewers. They're fetid, wild, and fierce. Of course, that was a long time ago. So where do you begin to even make this river swimmable?
Well, so the city of Paris is trying to address the different sources of pollution. Like I mentioned earlier, stormwater is one of the main sources, which happens when it rains. And what they're planning to do there is to build these underground storage tanks where the rainwater and the sewage, when it overflows like this, instead of going into the river, it goes into these underground pools, which are really, really big. We're talking multiple, Olympic pool sizes. And they fill these up. And then when the weather improves, then it's pumped out at a rate that the wastewater plants can process. And then that way there is no more overflow into the river. So this is one big infrastructure project they've undertaken. And it's very ambitious, but it's currently ongoing. So we don't know yet the results of that.
That sounds massive. I mean, huge, new, almost like runoff reservoirs. Is that accurate?
Yes, it is. It is accurate. It is massive. It's very ambitious, and we hope that it will achieve what it's planning to do, which is to retain these waters for enough time so they don't pollute the river and then they can be treated properly.
Yeah, you know, the Olympics, I mean, one thing it does, aside from sports, is liberate these massive amounts of cash. You know, over $1.5 billion the Olympics have given to this project. Do you think that's going to be enough?
That's a little bit difficult for me to judge since I'm not an expert in this big infrastructure project. It looks like it's a lot, but also we're talking about massive underground construction in a very busy city, which is not a trivial thing to do. So yes, there are costs associated with that. And there are other places in the world that are attempting projects like that. I think Paris is probably the first that will achieve a major project like this for the Olympics. But there are others. And yes, the costs are similar, I think.
So would you say this project then at the Seine is kind of a first project that hopefully will be followed by many other European cities and elsewhere in the world?
Absolutely. We hope so. We really are, in a way, liberating the waters, or basically the citizens in many places want to regain access to the natural water courses. And there are European events like the Big Jump, which is sort of one day a year where at a certain time of the day, people jump in the local rivers everywhere in Europe at the same time, at the same moment, to make a statement. They want to be able to do that every day. And it's tolerated, if you'd like. It's not always legal, but people do it. And and that's a clear statement there.
Dan, what is the standard that would need to be met for the Seine to be considered clean enough for people to swim?
So on one hand, you have the current regulations, the European regulations, and then they are translated into French law. So there are European directive, the bathing water directive. And, you know, the way that goes is that over a period of 4 years, you need to take so many samples. It's about a sample every week or every 2 weeks and analyze them. And then over 4 years, you need to have a geometric average of the values that is below a certain threshold in terms of number of bacteria, E. coli per 100 ml, for example. So the problem is that the current regulations require you to sample every week or every 2 weeks. And that is clearly insufficient to protect the health of the people. So the city of Paris is taking an approach that goes way beyond the regulations. And this is where we come in with our technology. We have rapid analyzers that can provide results within hours. So you can get same day results. So you can do a measurement today and later today you will know if the water quality is good enough to be swimming in it or not, if it's below that threshold that you set or not. So in a way, you have a regulatory approach which is followed, but on top of that, you have a high frequency and high resolution monitoring that is done that goes beyond what the regulations require in order to ensure public health.
Well, which would be critical if you're putting Olympic world athletes in the water, something that course organizers would want, wouldn't they? I mean, is one of the threats during the Olympics a heavy rainstorm, for example, that would put all this into a bit of a mess?
I think they will have to do monitoring of the water quality during those days. Indeed, if a big storm event comes and if the current infrastructure projects are not completed, then it would probably pollute significantly the river and it could pollute it for several days. So in that case, most likely, I don't know what the plans of the Olympic Committee are exactly and what their mitigation routes are. But most likely the event would have to be postponed until the water quality improves again.
We've seen other attempts, other Olympics in Rio, for example. I was there when they tried to clean up the waterways, but they essentially failed. Are you confident that this may happen successfully in 2024?
Well, I think the amount of effort put in place, both on the infrastructure and disinfecting the wastewater effluent from wastewater plants, and cleaning up illegal connections of the sewage network and so on. I mean, all of this it's a work that's ongoing, and it'll definitely have a big impact. And I don't think this kind of attempt has really been made in the past at this scale. So yes, I think I think this is the best chance we have to reach the water quality. Whether that will be the case or not, it's still to be seen, obviously, because some of these projects will only start operating in the coming months, so we don't really know the exact results. But all the simulations show that, yes, the impact should be important on the water quality. And yes, I do hope and I do trust that things will be on track and the Olympics will be in the sand.
And even if we do get there in Paris, which everybody would like, of course, do you think Parisians are going to get over their concerns about that filthy river that they love and go swimming?
Well, you know, Parisians and French people have a little bit of a tradition of complaining about things. But then when the things are there and they, you know, you have data that shows that water quality is good, I'm convinced that people will take advantage of that and, you know, cool off in the summer month by going to the Seine when they cannot go to the beach at the Atlantic or at the Mediterranean Sea. So, yes, I think, you know, there has been another project like this called the Paris Plage, where people would go and sort of lay down on the banks of the sand. There would be sand put there to make it look like a beach, and you had showers. And, you know, nobody expected that would be so popular, but it was. And then in 2017, they opened the first pools with in the Canal d'Ourcq, which is a canal which sort of feeds the Seine, or, well, it's a side canal of the Seine, and they had open water swimming in the canal there. They had to monitor every day. So we installed systems there that monitored water quality every day. Nobody knew whether that was going to be popular or not, but, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of people that go there every year to swim, so it is very popular. Mm-hmm. And so I think, yes, there will be skepticism at the beginning because of all the history of the Seine and, you know, the water. It's a big river and, you know, it has things developing in it. You can have algae, you can have other things, so the water may not be very clear. So, you know, people associate that with water quality, but in reality, big rivers can be like that even when they're extremely clean from a microbiological perspective.
Indeed.
And risk-free.
When the data's good, jump in, you're saying. Well, thank you very much, Dan. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Dan Angelesco is a scientist and founder of the water quality solutions company Fluidian. He's working on the Seine's cleanup efforts.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart MacLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, Canada is also trying to clean up its urban waterways. Earlier this year, the federal government announced a total of $750 million over the next 10 years for this work. Dalal Hanna is an assistant professor of conservation science at Carleton University in Ottawa. Her research focuses on freshwater ecosystems. Dalal, hello.
Hello.
So we just listened to Dan on the state of the Seine in Paris. How would you compare the Seine and its pollution to rivers and lakes in Canada's urban centres?
Well, I unfortunately don't think we can say that any Canadian urban waterways get an A+ in terms of their overall health and cleanliness. Every major urban waterway that I can think of in the Canadian context, spanning from the Yukon River, which runs through Whitehorse, to the Saskatchewan River, which runs through Saskatoon, the Don River in Toronto, the St. Lawrence in Montreal, the Outaouais in Ottawa. Just like the Seine, they all have problems associated with industrial and agricultural waste and pollution, sewage overflow, like Dan talked about in the Seine, and fragmentation of habitat or degradation, to name a few problems.
Yeah, those
that isn't to say that we aren't making efforts.
Yeah, I'm going to get to that. Those are big problems, though. You know, it's interesting because as Canadians, we think of pristine lakes, you know, in rural parts of our country. We're famous for that. But how do we think of water close to where we live and drive and work, you know, in these urban centers?
Well, I think that we unfortunately have created quite a bit of segregation between us and our urban waterways through things like putting ports into place and having infrastructure that prevents people from accessing those waterways, or through historical pollution, right? So if you think about the Don River in Toronto, my mother grew up in Toronto, and she was telling me, oh yeah, we definitely wouldn't swim there when we were kids, in part because it has this bad reputation. But that bad reputation comes from a history of not treating these rivers with respect, by throwing waste from industry like tanneries directly into the river, or having, you know, significant amounts of sewage overflow going into them. And so I think we tend to think of these urban rivers as places that we're not really connected to, but I think they represent an immense potential to connect with freshwaters, and that they are often just as clean as rivers that are in rural areas, because rivers flow over these long distances. And so, you know, in urban spaces, things that are happening upstream of the rivers are going to influence the rivers just as much as in rural areas.
So on that, you know, you're quite right. We've been talking about making these rivers better, cleaner for decades. So when it comes to actual cleaning up, as we just heard in the Seine, what can be done that would make, do you think, a measurable difference?
Well, there are unfortunately, lots of threats that affect freshwater ecosystems, you know, spanning from pollution of microplastics to nutrients, to nanomaterials, overexploitation. And so all these different factors that are really difficult to manage, in part because large rivers like the ones that we are talking about in urban contexts drain massive areas, right? They're part of these big watersheds. And so things that happen thousands of kilometers away can influence their health and cleanliness. That said, there are lots of things that we can do. And I think something that's happening right now in Toronto is a fantastic example. The city of Toronto is investing in rerouting sewage so that this problem of storm overflow can be eliminated, so that the river ends up not getting all this waste into it, which has huge impacts on water quality, of course. So that's kind of a local scale style of action that we can take, but there's also a much broader scale action that we can take in terms of just managing upstream of these waterways that we want to be able to benefit from. So that means things like being careful of industrial waste that goes into rivers or that's tolerated in rivers. And so that is pointing straight towards regulation and, you know, really having aggressive regulation that prevents waste from being deposited into rivers. But then we also need to think about regulation on the land. And so what happens when there's agriculture very close to waterways? Well, unfortunately, all the excess nutrients that are in that agriculture run off into the rivers and pollute them. Same thing when it comes to timber harvesting or tree planting. And so thinking about all these various approaches would be a really good way to try and protect these waterways and improve their health and their water quality.
So regulations we've heard about, and they change. Do you think, though, that governments are thinking about cleanup in the right ways, or are they missing something?
I'll start by saying that it's wonderful to see that the current government has committed to investing more money than there has historically been invested in freshwater protection in Canada. You talked about $750 million that they committed to this time around, but they did commit to $1 billion over the next 10 years. And so that's great to hear. I think that's a good part of their approach. But to put that number into perspective, I know that Toronto is investing $3 billion to build the tunnels that are going to be required to reroute untreated sewage away from the Don River. And so that just shows that, you know, financially, I think one of the things that we're doing wrong is, like, we're just not investing enough. And I think that's something that we really need to be thinking about, because freshwaters contribute not only to our physical, but our mental well-being on many levels. Everyone needs drinking water. And I think 80% of Canadian drinking water comes from surface water. So this is an important resource. We need to be investing in it. It's not something to play around with. And $1 billion over the next 10 years, it's just not enough. So that's the first thing I think that they're doing wrong. Yeah. And then beyond that, I think that there's currently a pretty big reliance on small grassroots organizations to take the lead on helping protect freshwaters. And I think that's wonderful, because these organizations can have really important impact. But these organizations are subject to ebbs and flows of funding. And so, you know, having inconsistent funding, uncertain funding really influence their ability to take action. I think another thing that we need to be thinking about is the scale at which we operate. So it's fine and well to say, hey, we're going to clean up the Don and take a bunch of local action on the Don. But the reality is that these rivers, or major rivers like the St. Lawrence, for example, are impacted by things that are happening thousands of kilometers away. So thinking at scale, thinking right. about cross-boundary management is really important.
And from your research, what have you discovered about the relationship between sort of healthy water systems and healthy cities?
Well, water systems, as I was saying, are very important for physical and mental well-being. So they provide us with all these resources that are very tangible and easy to think about, like drinking water or fish for communities that rely on fish for sustenance. Beyond that, they provide us with all these other benefits that we might not think about so much. So, for example, rivers are very big climate regulators. They store massive amounts of carbon. And so thinking about them at that scale is very important, something to know about. Beyond that, they're places that contribute to our emotional well-being. They're places that we can go to recreate, to feel good. And I think, you know, coming back to your question about what are we doing wrong in terms of protecting and restoring these places is really focusing on that emphasis of the importance of creating connection between people and waterways. And I love Dan's story of how, you know, they built this thing on the Seine and they weren't sure if people mm-hmm. would go to it or on one of the rivers in France. And then in the end, hundreds of thousands of people go there every year. And I think that's true of our urban waterways as well. If we care for them, we're going to kind of move into this wonderful feedback loop where people start caring about them more and then care for them more and benefit from them. So we have a lot to gain.
That's a very good point, Dalal. I have the reverse question just briefly, too. Do we need to minimize how much we humans impact our waterways in order to keep them clean?
Well, I think we need to minimize how much certain human activities impact our waterways, absolutely, through things like regulation in terms of being careful of how industry is regulated and what type of infrastructure we put along shorelines that are very sensitive places that are in need of protection. But that doesn't mean that we can't interact with those waterways in sustainable ways. I think it's wonderful. You know, to me, a healthy watershed or a healthy waterway is not only one that has clean water and fish and invertebrates and a good water flow, but it's also one that's connected to the people that live in its community. I think connection to community is a really important element of health of waterways, and we can do that in a sustainable way. There's all kinds of ways to access water without it damaging the shoreline, be it through docks or through kind of specific types of ramps. And so we do need to be careful of how we utilize water and making sure that that's sustainable, but I don't think that that's a reason to segregate ourselves from water and not, you know, have it be an active part of our life. In fact, I believe that the contrary is true. The more we're connected to water and we think about it and we care about it, the more we're going to be inclined to take good care of it on other scales and be able to benefit from it in turn.
That's a perfect way to end our conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Dalal Hanna is an assistant professor of conservation science at Carleton University.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.